From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
The scene has really gone crazy out here right now.
It just seems that every time we turn around, there's another store that's either being looted or burned.
More looting taking place here.
Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley has imposed a dawn to dusk curfew on the area.
The curfew has been extended to include the entire Los Angeles city limits and to include Los Angeles County boundaries of Vernon Avenue on the
That's not right! That's not right!
Can we all get along? Can we get along?
Hello again, Warren Olney back with a special edition of Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. It's our third day in a week of special programs about the Rodney King riot of 1992, America's worst civil disturbance in the 20th century. More than 50 people were killed, thousands were injured. Estimates of property damage ranged from $1 billion on up. Today, we'll focus on efforts to reconstruct South Los Angeles, on the dramatic transformation of Koreatown, and how devastation led to inspiration. As the violence was dying down, Mayor Tom Bradley called Peter Uberoth, the man who ran the only Olympic Games ever to make a profit in Los Angeles in 1984. Uberoth remembers it well.
I was innocently driving down Coast Highway when the mayor called and said, in day two of the riots, this thing is completely out of hand. We need help. And would you come down? And I got down there, and we didn't have the government was not participating correctly at the time, and the law enforcement people were trying to get a handle on it, and so. And there was going to be no budget for anything after the devastation. So, can we get the private sector to invest? And so, the mayor formed a one-day corporation, and that would have only a five-year life, and asked me to head it. And so, I got some people. And we drove down from where we lived, and people drove from other parts of the city, and some people that were in the inner city, and we founded something called Rebuild LA. The good news is the government stayed out our way. The president at the time and the governor didn't want anything to do with LA. Nobody wanted to touch LA, and people in the private sector said, look, I'll open a branch. I'll start. We were just trying to encourage somebody that had 1,000 employees open something in the devastated area for 20 employees and experiment with it. If it works, expand it and let's in the private sector. Let's all not use taxpayer money. I make a case that taxpayer money is given to the government is normally inefficiently spent is a nice way to waste it is sometimes more accurate, but the private sector, the people people in the private sector, gave me $5 million checks, and several of them individuals, and just to say, look, let's get started, let's change the dialogue and the devastated area in the downtown of Los Angeles.
Ultimately, Rebuild LA raised just $500 million, but the first task was to determine where the money ought to be spent. Bernard Kinsey was an early leader of Rebuild LA.
What we decided to do was to find areas that only businesses could operate in that were clearly needed by the community. For instance, We did a survey by the McKinsey Company and found that only three things that were oversupplied for the area were gun stores, liquor stores, and funeral homes. So what we said was all the services that normal communities would have, in other words, the suburbs, our community was not getting. So we went out specifically and began to target those industries. We hired some of the best people in the country as account managers to go after those particular segments. One of the biggest segments we had a great deal of success with is the supermarkets. During the riots, we had probably six supermarkets in the entire area impacted by the disturbances, And during my tenure, the first 2 years, we had over 33 supermarkets, full-service supermarkets. So that's just one example, but there were many in almost every aspect of the services for South Los Angeles. RLA led the charge on that.
Rebuild LA was designed to last just 5 years. Jackie DuPont Walker was a community developer in South LA, and she also signed on.
I call the incident of April 29th an economic referendum, because if you look at some of the film of what people took, you saw survival items, not luxury items. And so I think what Rebuild LA, RLA, was able to bring was the redefinition of what it meant to invest in disenfranchised communities. But it helped corporate America and national brands understand that they were missing a market.
Walker says 5 years was never enough, and Bernard Kinsey agrees RLA wasn't enough either.
And I always said that we didn't have the only agency. We had one agency of many agencies really trying to treat a really massive problem of a $2 billion loss in a community that, was devastated.
Here again, Peter Uberoth.
It's not Rebuild LA. It was the idea of the mayor wanting to have a private sector, and they could find a few of us that would donate our time for a while, and it got things going, and that's all it intended to do, and it did it and did it very well, and nothing else was happening, and there was nobody else in the hunt, as we say. There was nobody else that showed up for the fight, and other than some local leaders who provided positive leadership and joined the board of Rebuild LA, and lots of people with different ideas and different coming from different directions and all races and religions, but the bottom line is it's a much better area, and there are people being able to go to a real grocery store and are there enough? No, but there's a lot more than there were.
Mayor Bradley left office soon after establishing Rebuild LA. His elected successor, Richard Reardon, was an early board member, but he remains unimpressed.
Rebuild LA was a great idea that didn't work too well. Politics played a big role in it. They wanted people in the inner city, the lenders, everything, to be their friend. And so they couldn't be tough as far as running things. People who were politically astute got the money that the federal government sent in, but they didn't know how to run a business.
John Hope Bryant founded Operation Hope to serve poor communities. He became a national figure. He takes umbrage at criticism of Tom Bradley's Rebuild LA.
I think that this falls in the category of no good deed shall go unpunished. They're doing the federal government's job. Let's start there. The president, nice guy, but came in town and basically said, this is too big for me, or I don't understand it, or not my box to check, or whatever, and left. And the mayor, God bless him, Tom Bradley, took the limited resources he had, and he knew he really needed leadership. And he also knew that 91% of all jobs come from the private sector, only 8% jobs from the government, and that what the inner city needs is a market economy. And so the bad news is, with all this stuff got burned down. Mostly, it was all commercial buildings. The good news that was, when it burned down, you could rebuild it the way it was attractive and compelling to market forces for today. And by the way, the Boys Market that went away was replaced by a Ralph's. That was an upgrade. And, Rebuild LA helped to do that.
Jackie DuPont Walker points out that resources were even harder to come by after another disaster, many times more costly than the Rodney King riots.
With the Northridge earthquake coming in, resources and attention went there because it appeared to be more critical. And then you had the recession during that time, pretty much like the recession stopping things now.
But Walker says that Rebuild LA did not lose track of its mission.
So I think, and given the full context of the time and the mission that RLA set in place, yes, and I even see now some of the fruit of those labors as new Smart and Finals roll out in the communities, as Walgreens comes in, the places it did not want to come before they simply were taken to the neighborhood and said, this is it, to look at the half-full community instead of the community in total disarray.
Rebuild LA was the short-term, privately funded response to the devastation left by the riots of 1992. As years passed, rebuilding continued, with public investment from the Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles. It used the footprint left by Rebuild LA. Carolyn Hull is project manager for South LA.
Well, I think at the very least what they've done is actually provided us with a wealth of information about the areas and the land that was vacant in South Los Angeles. And that was a resource that was critical to us as we looked through and tried to look at the area and tried to do our own economic development planning. In terms of what buildings were burnt out, where the vacant lots were, and as developers tried to come in, we were able to use that information to actually direct them toward areas that could potentially be used for their own development.
David Roberts grew up in South Los Angeles, and after the riots, he worked for two city council members. Now he's USC's Associate Director for Government Relations, and he's not so impressed by the rebuilding efforts.
From what I recall, and bear with me, I was an intern with Mark Ridley Thomas's office at the time. I think there were some expectations from Rebuild LA, and I think for the most part, those expectations were not realized. And you later saw a push to create these community redevelopment project areas, these revitalization project areas in response to the civil unrest. I think if you go back in time and you measure what the redevelopment project areas have been able to do as far as building affordable housing units, creating retail commercial services, grocery stores, jobs, et cetera, there's been a much greater success rate with the government-funded or government-assisted, government-led efforts with the redevelopment agency than you had with the initiative with Rebuild LA that was primarily focused on private investment.
So, did the work go quickly?
I think irregular. Starts and stops, spurts. And so you had supermarket chains that came in at that time, many of whom have stayed and expanded. And others that have come as a result. For example, had Vons and Ralph's or Food for Less and Smart and Final not come in, then Fresh and Easy may never have looked at the inner city. And we still haven't gotten Trader Joe's to pay attention, but they may never have come. Had not Benjamin Moore Paints and Chief Auto Parts come in, then the others would not possibly have come in.
Here again is Carolyn Hull of the now defunct Community Redevelopment Agency.
I think there's been a tremendous amount of investment in South Los Angeles. I mean, we can look to the projects such as Chesterfield Square, the Baldwin Hills Mall, just to name two. There is the new health, the Kaiser's new health center on Manchester Avenue. I think if you drive around the South Los Angeles, you will see a great deal of new investment, and certainly new retail stores have come in.
So if it wasn't Rebuild LA, what did it?
Well, I think it's this concept of mega communities. I don't think any one organization, whether it's the private sector or the government or community stakeholders, can do it alone. And I think the expectation that one organization, whatever it may be, can do it alone is a misnomer. What we need is a collective approach. And one of the good things about CRA was that it at least it had a place-based approach to it. It was geographically bound. So all the investment, though in some cases in Los Angeles and South LA was limited, all that investment had to be placed in one area. So the private sector, the government, and community stakeholders came together to actually make these things happen.
USC's David Roberts.
I think the success that Carolyn was referring to earlier, when you look at Chesterfield Square as an example, that 20 acres, that's a concentrated effort to do something and create a retail shopping center for South Los Angeles. There's been examples along Central Avenue where you have along about a mile stretch of Central Avenue between Adams and Vernon, literally hundreds of new units of affordable housing, two new grocery stores, examples along Figueroa near USC. There's been a dramatic transformation of that corridor since the 1992 civil unrest. So there's pockets of improvement, but to look at a large area like South Los Angeles, a million people in you know, close to 50 square miles, it's difficult without, again, strategically focusing those efforts on smaller geographic areas.
Kerman Maddox is head of Dakota Communications and a member of the board of directors of the First AME Church.
if your objective weren't, I'd say, if you looked at L.A. 20 years ago and look at it now, you'd have to say things are much better in South L.A. For example, a lot of basic services that people in other communities take for granted that did not exist in South L.A. are there today. You know, you got banks that are servicing the community. You have supermarkets all over the place. You have a few sit-down restaurants that you didn't have before. You have takeout. So you have a lot of fundamental services that weren't there before that are there now. So, you know, is it perfect? Obviously, it's not perfect, but a lot of change has happened, and a lot of good things have happened. And more important than that, when you go to these establishments, if you look at the people who are working there, it's people from the local community. So not only do you have way more services, but you have entities that have established themselves, and they've hired people in the local community to work there.
The riot of 1992 and the rebuilding changed many lives. Jackie DuPont Walker talks about what it meant to her.
It really did connect the city of Los Angeles into a large area, not just sprawling neighborhoods, but it connected us. Those of us who went through that period will forever remember, even in frustrating times, we are connected to the San Gabriel, San Fernando Valley, San Pedro, South L.A., East L.A., and Central L.A. I'm not sure I got that before. And I think sometimes, even as I do commission work, and we travel to different parts of the city, it is a very clear reminder in my head of what Rodney King said. We are in this together.
So 20 years later, rebuilding is still a very much a work in progress. Los Angeles will be more connected, quite literally, when the new Expo line opens to much fanfare this coming weekend. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez recently took a preview ride with Metro CEO Arthur Leahy and County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky.
When this line opens, we have the blue line going to South L.A., and we have this line going out Exposition through neighborhoods with direct access to Santa Monica, ultimately, and downtown L.A. From there, you can go to Hollywood or wherever you want to go.
And that means what to you?
Well, it means people will be able to have easy access to get all over Southern California in a much more rapid and convenient fashion. When the Crenshaw line opens up, that will be all the stronger.
I think this city has matured over the last 20 years in a huge way. There were people 20 years ago who said, you can't build an Exposition light rail line because no white person is going to ride through the Crenshaw District. And that was total nonsense. Actually, people are going to learn about the Crenshaw District, and Crenshaw residents are going to learn about the Santa Monica community. These are communities that were disconnected from one another on both sides, and now they're connected. And we are going to have huge ridership, and it's good for the city. It's good for the city to have people visit each other's communities, shop in each other's communities, recreate in each other's communities. And I've always been a big believer in that when you know people, when you interact with people, you can like them. When you don't know people, myths about them.
And raw infrastructure can play a role in that.
Absolutely. Public mass transportation is the great equalizer in this town.
The Expo line will go from Pico and Flower downtown, south to USC, and then west all the way to Culver City. You can ride free on Saturday and Sunday, and there are going to be special events of various kinds at some of the stations. Rochelle Mills was born and raised and still lives in the Crenshaw District. She's an architect, member of the South Los Angeles Area Planning Commission, also the Crenshaw Design Review Board. Rochelle Mills, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard Zev Yaroslavsky talk about what people had said about whether white people would be willing to ride into other people's neighborhoods. Do you think racism played a role in making it difficult, more difficult perhaps than Peter Uberoth and others hoped, to get investment in the devastated areas?
I'm really glad he brought that up because I don't like to talk about race, but it had to play a role. I think when the riots came, you could not deny the fear that people had because of what went on racially. But I think a benefit that came out of it, it's hard to call it a benefit, is when the earthquake came and the freeway was closed down, it forced people to drive through these communities that they wouldn't have driven through before. And now I see a lot more diversity in Crenshaw that would not have come because people were so terrified after the riots.
What's special about Crenshaw right now?
Well, what I love about Crenshaw is the opportunities that are coming because of the transit line. You've got a line that is connecting from downtown to Culver City, Culver City spent millions of dollars and has done an amazing job in reinventing itself. And now you've got a corridor, a transportation corridor, that is going to connect so many areas of Los Angeles, particularly where I live. You've got a dearth of underutilized industrial buildings that are perfect for creative space. Now that we've got people who will be passing through that, I think we have an opportunity for that to be realized. And once you connect it with the Crenshaw line, connecting Wilshire all the way to the airport, you have an opportunity to reimagine Crenshaw Boulevard with housing, with workspace, with shopping and commerce. I think it's just an incredibly exciting period of time.
You have to reimagine, though. It hasn't happened yet.
No, it hasn't happened yet, but the possibilities are there. You're seeing right now a lot of the shopping centers that are not performing as well as they should. These are the areas that David Roberts and some of the others were talking about with Rebuild LA. It was the catalyst, but they haven't performed as well as they should. Now you're seeing that those parcels are being consolidated, and that means the development is coming. And when I speak to the council office about some of the things that are coming, I'm just real excited. In the next 5 to 10 years, this will be a different place, and I hope people can remember the excitement that, and not fall back on pessimism and what should have happened. But things take time, and when you're working in the inner city, unfortunately, it seems to take a little longer.
Rochelle Mills in the Crenshaw District. Hector Sanchez was 12 years old in 1992. He's now administration director at the Community Coalition. That's a social justice nonprofit founded in 1990, before the riots, to improve conditions for Latinos and African Americans in South Los Angeles. Hector Sanchez, good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Do you agree with Rochelle Mills that there has been progress, but that there hasn't been enough?
Oh, I definitely agree with Rochelle. There's definitely progress that has happened. You know, just from hearing all the conversations that we heard is that people feel there's palpable differences in the community. I mean, crime has gone down, significantly down. The relationship between police and community has definitely improved. There's a willingness now from police to listen to the community. It's difficult to see these changes or for people to feel these changes when the median income has gone down for both Latinos and African Americans. You know, we still have an issue with lack of jobs. And no real economic development that people feel is tangibly happening in the community. We still have a lot of vacant lots. However, I still, like Rochelle said, I do think that there is work that needs to be done and that people need to, you know, come together and continue to push for that.
Just want to remind our listeners, especially if you've just turned in, this is a special edition of Which Way LA, 20 years after the Rodney King riots, a series of programs going on all week at 1 o'clock and at 7 o'clock in the evening, repeated at 7 o'clock in the evening. Hector Sanchez, what's your take with regard to that question that sort of hangs over everything in Los Angeles, even though people wish it didn't, and that is race? Do you think that that's one of the reasons that even though Peter Uberoth was able to get some $5 million checks from some people, there really hasn't been more redevelopment than there has?
I definitely feel that race has definitely played a role in all this. I think that, you know, we in any other community, I feel like if any of this would have happened, the redevelopment process would have been a much quicker process. However, you know, we are talking about an impoverished community that was plagued with violence and crime and, you know, all the negative stereotypes. And, you know, it's an area as Rochelle said, people were scared to come to. And as a result, you see that there hasn't been, you know, that private investment in our community. You have what you've seen more is that the emergence of nonprofits, churches having to fill that void that the private sector has left. You know, churches having to build homes, affordable housing units, and, you know, et cetera. And so it's just... I feel that definitely race has played into all this.
In this context, Rochelle Mills, back to you. I should tell our listeners, too, that you're the founder and director of Arcatours. That's an interesting organization. I hope we'll have time to ask about. But you have said that Crenshaw District is really the last black community in Los Angeles. We know there's been a tremendous amount of moving around by people and a lot of movement out of the areas affected by the riots by African-Americans and a lot of movement in by Latinos and others. Tell us a bit more about Crenshaw and that phrase you gave it, the last black community in Los Angeles.
Well, it's interesting because one of the areas, Leimert Park, people talk about it because of all of the potential for it to be such an important cultural center. Since I have been in Los Angeles, it has never reached its potential. And one of the things that people talk about is that as a cultural center, it's a melting pot for blacks. The demographics are changing now, and so one of the difficulties in developing and adding to the new businesses is trying to recognize that we do have a changing demographic. The Crenshaw District used to be predominantly Japanese. It's now predominantly black. As Latinos are moving in, as whites are moving in, and others from other countries are moving in, we may have to revisit how we develop Crenshaw. Since that time, I remember right after the riots, the Design Professionals Coalition came about, and it was a group of architects and those in the building community that wanted to cohesively pull together the discussion on planning and redeveloping the area. And there were so many very good ideas and then so many caricatures of what Crenshaw should be, complete with pyramids on every corner. So I think we do have in the redevelopment, we also have a subtext of race that we have to discuss. And not race in a negative way, but race in terms of the transition of California and all of California cities. And the Crenshaw District is no different.
Back to Hector Sanchez of the Community Coalition. Tell us about your plans for this Sunday. It's my understanding that you're going to be taking people on a tour.
Well, actually, this Sunday we're having a fair and a rally to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the civil unrest. A rally, and we're actually going down the street from where our offices are at. There's a huge vacant lot that has been sitting there vacant for over 20 years since the civil unrest, actually. And, you know, it's just a blight in the community. There hasn't been any development that has been attempted in that area. And we feel it's been, you know, in a way kind of held hostage because there has nothing that has happened to that area. And then we're going to have a fair because, there has been changes. There has been positive changes. The community has come together. Without the emergence of community groups, I feel we wouldn't have seen the changes that we have seen. And so it's a time to also to celebrate and just, you know that we still have to roll up our sleeves and continue to push forward.
Hector Sanchez again with the Community Coalition. Rochelle Mills with in the Crenshaw District, where she is an architect. Stay with us, if you will. I want to tell our listeners what's coming up next before we go to a very brief break. Later on, we're going to hear how some other architects and designers responded to the deep sense of evil and the license for disobedience that they felt after the violence was over. You'll be very interested to hear how they get out of those phrases. It's Inner City Arts. That's an oasis in a bleak industrial area near Skid Row where fifth grade kids from the LAUSD are learning Shakespeare. In a moment, we'll talk about rebuilding a Koreatown. Again, this is a special edition of Which Way LA, part of a week's worth of programs on the violence, the causes, and the aftermath of the Rodney King riots that devastated so much of Los Angeles 20 years ago.
It changed my political views almost instantaneously. It changed and adjusted my musical tastes. I wound up programming an underground rock station in San Diego a couple of years later. That album, it had just a profound effect on my life that resonates still.
That was the voice of the Clippers, Ralph Lawler, talking about the Broadway cast recording of Hair. Hear his full guest DJ set online at kcrw.com/guestdjproject.
support KCRW by shopping our online store. Browse through an array of fun premiums like exotic trips, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, and dinners. We also have the latest KCRW t-shirts, mugs, hats, and other fun exclusives too. Take a look before it's too late. Quantities are limited. Become a member today and reward yourself while you're at it. Visit kcrw.com/store.
We're not only back with today's special edition of Which Way L.A. Koreatown was officially designated in Los Angeles neighborhood in 1978. It's 5 square miles just west of downtown between Beverly and Olympic on the north and south, and very roughly between Wilton and Crenshaw on the east and west. Among American cities, only Midtown Manhattan and Chicago's north side are more densely populated. Koreatown has the largest Korean population outside of Korea itself, but the largest resident group there is Hispanic, reflecting again on the diversity of Los Angeles. During the riot, Koreatown experienced more property damage than the rest of the city put together. Jerry Yu, who is now at Cal State Fullerton, was executive director of the Korean American Coalition in 1992. And Jerry Yu, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Warren.
I remember talking to you back on one of our early Which Way LA programs in 1992, and you said that at that time, people in the Korean community felt they were betrayed by the police and by the rest of the city. Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, as the commission reports have found, concluded afterwards, the LAPD definitely did not have preparations in place. While the rest of the community, I mean, the rest of us all knew what was coming up. It had been building for months, and once the verdicts came out, we definitely knew that there may be, rioting. And actually, on that day, the verdicts came out from Simi Valley in the afternoon. The community plan among everybody in the city, all the city leaders, the plan was we're going to gather at the First AME Church, where the mayor and city council members, community leaders would all be there from all the different communities to ask for calm and not to riot, and obviously that didn't work.
It didn't work. We heard yesterday from Kerman Maddox, who's on the board of the First AME Church, how difficult it was for him just to get there, and
right,
how little the people inside the church who had managed to get there knew about what was going on outside, Tom Bradley and others calling for calm when the chaos was in fact the reality. Well, how did the Korean community react? I think we all remember the pictures that were run again and again on television of people on rooftops with shotguns.
Yeah, I mean, it gets back to your first question. When all of this erupted, and I was also there at the church, and we couldn't even get in because it was so packed. But when we got back to the office, turned on the TV, and we saw what was happening, I mean, the city was in flames. And you know, when you called back, all the telephone circuits were busy, first of all. But when you did get through to 911, there was a recording basically telling you to fend for yourself. So that's what I meant by betrayal. And so as far as the reaction, I mean, I think it all kind of took us by surprise that first night. But then when it continued the next morning, I think the new word that came into play, like for me, like last year, is tsunami. I think that's like the closest word I can say as far as, you know, our gut feeling. It was just so vast and so surprising that it would continue the next morning. All this burning and destruction and just, you know, violence that people have been talking about. So I think, first of all, it was kind of a shock. People fled because, I mean, you know, in danger for themselves. But then just given the where Koreans came from as far as immigrants, making a living in these small mom-and-pop shops, there was this feeling that, hey, we can't just run because this is our livelihood. This is where we earn our living, and that's all we have left. So I think that's where the sense of we're not going to run, but we're going to, you know, try and fend for ourselves, as the police recording said, and dig in. And that's where you saw the videos of people trying to protect their businesses.
2,000 businesses ultimately destroyed. How many of them reopened?
I don't know if anybody has an accurate estimate, but the last I've the statistics that I've seen, a small minority were actually able to reopen.
Again, Jerry Yu, now at Cal State Fullerton, was executive director of the Korean American Coalition in 1992. Kai Ma is managing editor of the Asian American Writers Workshop. That's a literary organization headquartered in New York. She was formerly editor-in-chief of Korea-Am. That's a Los Angeles-based publication, national publication for the Korean American community. Kai Ma, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
You were 15 when all of this happened. Tell us about it from your point of view and from the point of view of your extended family.
Sure. Well, Saegu, which is what Korean Americans call the riots, it's often referenced as this coming of age moment for Koreans in America. And I could definitely relate to that because it happened during my own coming of age. I was a teenager in LA and close enough to see smoke and hear some nearby looting and rioting. I had older male friends who had to guard their parents' stores. And other friends, their families had shops in K-Town and South L.A., and those shops were either torched or suffered minor damages because they were protected by customers and members of the community. But for these reasons, also because of the shooting of Latasha Harlins by Korean shopkeeper Soon Ja-Do, I knew that Koreans were part of this very complicated and now explosive story. But, you know, the reason the riots felt so close and personal was because my family, mostly immigrants from South Korea, worked or lived in Koreatown, and they still do. And they worked as seamstresses, and they ran clothing or thread businesses and later restaurants and 99-cent stores. And during those 3 days, you know, I feared for their safety.
You said that you mentioned the Latasha Harlins and Soon Ja-Do incident. That's come up every day in our programs. One person or another has mentioned it. Latasha Harlins was a young African American woman who came in and had an altercation with Soon Ja-Do, who was the manager of a grocery store. Ultimately, Soon Ja-Do shot and killed Latasha Harlins, who had $2 in her hand, and Soon Ja-Do then got probation, although she was convicted. So that obviously left a bad taste in many mouths. Let me go back to Rochelle Mills on that issue. Do you recall that in particular? It had happened just before the riots themselves. Was that big news in the Crenshaw District and amongst people that you lived with?
It was a big deal, and I hate to make it seem rosy, but we didn't concentrate on that. I'll tell you, I fully did not expect the pandemonium that came out of the Rodney King case. I saw, and most of my friends would tell you privately, we watched the tape of the riots, and we saw what the police did, and it was inexcusable. But the circumstances that led to it, we saw that as well. So we fully didn't expect there to be this coalition around him that would result in, I mean, the mass chaos and destruction. I still scratch my head. The number of people who were innocently affected by it, I still scratch my head over it. So I remember the Latasha Harlin case, and I remember the, just being puzzled by how the justice was meted out on that one. But we fully did not anticipate what was going to happen with the Rodney King verdict.
Alex Ko is a filmmaker in Los Angeles. His parents owned two businesses in Koreatown in 1992. Alex Ko, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me on, Warren.
What happened to your parents' businesses?
Well, they had two businesses around the corner of 3rd and Catalina. One of them was looted and burned to the ground, and the other one was looted and destroyed.
What is their situation now, 20 years later?
Well, I mean, I think they would say that it was God's blessing that allowed this to happen. They, through a lot of struggle and sacrifice and a little luck, they actually have a successful small business now, but it's nowhere near the Koreatown area.
Kai Ma, let me go back to you. Tell us about the rebuilding, what's happened in Koreatown in the past 20 years.
Well, a lot has happened in only the past few years. In 2009, there were two very dramatic announcements made only weeks apart. And despite the downtown real estate slump, where even Frank Gehry projects were being shelved, you know, K-Town locals and Korean nationals were defying the economic downturn. And these two major developments led by ambitious South Korean private investors were launching. One was Korean Air's $1 billion proposal to build two new skyscrapers downtown. And then there's a 43-floor tower along Figueroa. And the last time Asian money had poured into downtown LA real estate in this fashion was during a Japanese boom of the during the late 1980s. And now it's the Korean investors that have their eye on LA, and they're investing in different ways, coming in with both corporate and individual money. And then over in K-Town, we have folks like David Lee, and he's a big-time local Korean-American investor. And he bought up undervalued buildings during the depressed post-riot market. He had the foresight and the confidence that K-Town would expand and prosper. And today he's one of Southern California's most powerful landlords. So, you know, add all this up, and 20 years after the riots, you know, K-Town is entering a new type of limelight. And the most dramatic transformation has to do with these new luxury condos, and one's called the Solaire Project on Wilshire and Western. There's one called the Summit on 6th. And then there's the Courtyard Madong, which is an entertainment complex on Western. And, you know, along with that, there's, you know, the tall, glossy commercial buildings and these multi-level sports and spas and shopping centers. And then, of course, you know, the lavish clubs. And all of this is kind of transforming the city skyline. K-Town's gotten taller, more dense. There's metro subway lines and more foot traffic and just a lot of activity. It is the largest Koreatown in the United States, and its growth is very much tied to this ambitious investing, both from South Koreans as well as Korean-Americans.
So Alex Koh, our filmmaker in Los Angeles, your parents lost their businesses and are glad to be out of there. How do you feel about it when you're driving around in your old neighborhood and what you see are the kinds of buildings just described by Kai Ma?
I mean, I grew up around Koreatown and spent, you know, 20 years, 30 years there. And if someone had told me back when I was a kid that there would be luxury apartments and luxury condos in Koreatown, I just wouldn't have believed it. It's kind of shocking to me that that kind of development has taken place. And it's also, like, if someone hadn't told you, Warren, that a riot had taken place in 92 in Koreatown, there would be nowhere for you to know. There's no physical evidence of it. It's just sort of, everything's built on the ashes of this looting. I'd like to add one thing you had asked earlier about my parents and what had happened to their business. A lot of people, I think it's hard for them to get a sense of what it means for that business to have been destroyed. My family story isn't a unique one. They came here in the 70s, and it was like kind of a big deal for being able to immigrate to the States, and it was kind of a dream for them to be here. My mother worked in a sweatshop. My father was a gardener. He cleaned pools. They saved this little bit of money for years to open this store, and they spent all their time there. So when it was destroyed, it was a destruction of the American dream that they had been chasing for decades.
Let me go back to Hector Sanchez of the Community Coalition. What a very different kind of story we hear about Korean immigration, both then and now, than we hear about Latino immigration or Hispanic immigration. Now, tell us how this all sounds to you.
You know, it's I'm not gonna, you know, tell you I'm an expert on Latino immigration or
sure,
or much of that. But you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I remember, I did mention that I was 12 during the civil unrest, is that it's difficult for me to say that the unrest happened because of the verdict or because of Latosha Harding's, but you know, there was a series of activities and conditions that were happening that impacted South LA in general, the community as a whole, and there were Latinos that lived in this community. I mean, the fact that, you know, a lot of my friends at that time were getting picked up by the police just because they were, you know, in groups of three or four, and, you know, being taken to police stations and, you know, entered into this database. So it's just, it's something that really impacted the community of South LA, and it's difficult for me to say that it was just because of the verdict or Latosha Harding's. That definitely had, you know, added to the whole
added fuel to the whole situation.
Alex Koh, back to you. Apparently, not apparently, but according to demographers, there are more Hispanics living in Koreatown than there are Koreans or Korean-Americans. What about the economic situation there? Is there a great diversity between them and the people living in the luxury condos?
I think that I've been thinking about sort of why the riots had happened and kind of the narrative that's out there. And I think there's rightly focus put on the LAPD and sort of but I think that there's a lot of sort of focus put on that there was a animosity between Latinos and Koreans or Koreans and African Americans. What I want to say is that my parents, they had a lot of Latino customers and African American customers, and they had no idea that there would be some sort of racial animosity towards them. I mean, they employed Latinos and African Americans from the neighborhoods. So they had friends there, Latinos and African Americans from the neighborhoods. So they had no idea that that would occur. I think there has to be a lot of questioning about sort of the social, like as you point out, the social economic conditions that led to people being so upset that they would burn down the city they lived in. And I think that, as Kai pointed out, that there are these luxury condos and beautiful buildings that have arisen in Koreatown, but I think a lot of the poverty and the difficult conditions still remain.
Let me go back to Jerry Yu again. He was executive director of the Korean-American Coalition at the time. He's now at Cal State Fullerton. And as we began this segment of our program, I reminded you that you had said on this program 20 years ago that the Korean community felt betrayed. We heard at the beginning of this program Peter Uberoth say that private money was what was needed. Here in Koreatown, we have a lot of redevelopment, a lot of rebuilding, and it's private money, but it came from Korea. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, before I answer that, I wonder if I could go back and address the root causes of why all of this, you know, erupted for a second. I mean, I was older and I was there, and like I said in the beginning, those of us that were working in the community, we knew there was something that was coming. This has been building for years, and in another new term that has come to play is a perfect storm. I mean, when at that time, there was a huge recession, a deep, deep recession, not like today, but at that time it was very bad, where people were laid off, the aerospace industry was crashing, so a lot of people were hurting. And rioting is something that just, it's an expression, a venting of frustration and rage and a hopelessness. That's what Reverend Martin Luther King said, and that's what Jesse Jackson says. So this thing, in my view, and people disagree to this day, but there was a lot of pent-up anger, hopelessness, anger directed at the police, the government, and no jobs. And when rioting happens historically, it happens where people have, you know, have the least hope. So when you look at the pattern geographically of where the destruction and burning and looting happened, it was in the lower-income areas of L.A., very broad. And where did Korean immigrants open businesses? Alex was just saying, that's very typical.
Okay. Now, that's all the time that we have for this segment of our program. Jerry Yu, again, now at Cal State Fullerton. Thanks to you. Thanks to Kai Ma at the Asian American Writers Workshop. Thanks to Alex Koh, a filmmaker who grew up in Koreatown. We also appreciate Rochelle Mills, the architect from the Crenshaw District, and Hector Sanchez, director of the Community Coalition. The violence and the rioting of 1992 were terrifying for Los Angeles. For some people, they were also inspiring. To tell that story, KCRW's Francis Anderton visited Inner City Arts.
The feeling when after the Rodney King thing happened and the riots were taking place in the city, there was this deep sense of foreboding as you would drive around in the city. And it was like a feeling of evil kind of hanging over the place like an invisible cloud. The whole field of energy in the city was something that was permissive to allowing people to be completely disobedient. It was like an energy that fueled their disobedience. It was the strangest thing I've ever encountered in my life. I'm getting chills as I'm talking to you. It was the strangest experience I ever had. And when that was over, there was this kind of sense of relief and the sense of rebuilding, and Michael was plugged into it at that kind of time when, you know, everybody was thinking, what can we do with our city? How are we going to rebuild this? How are we going to go in some direction that transforms this kind of anger and frustration that a lot of people feel into something that's positive and that's something that affirms the new possibilities of our city?
One group that was particularly struck by new possibilities was architects, and one of them was Michael Moltzen, who had moved to Los Angeles excited by the formal experimentation that was then going on in architecture offices and schools.
I had started to work for Frank Gehry on the Disney Concert Hall, which was a project that was very much meant to represent the city and what the future of the city was and its newfound confidence that it was emerging as very much a world city and a city that had a deep creative culture that existed here. When the riots took place, in a way, all of that got called into question. Not so much that there was a creative culture here, but that the insular debate that was taking place about form, about materials, about what this architecture was about seemed really separate from this new reality, which was that the city where all of this work existed was in a deep state of trouble.
So how did you express this?
Well, I was like a lot of architects in the beginning. You were just trying to do whatever you could. It was like triage. We went out to clean up sites and tried to help people understand how they might be able to rebuild and rebuild quickly. But those were all really small gestures. And I, like a lot of architects, were trying to figure out what this meant and how to be involved in a much, much larger way.
Michael was introduced to Bob Bates and became designer of a new space for inner city arts, which had been until then housed in temporary trailers. Together with architects Marmal Radziner and landscape designer Nancy Gosley Power, he transformed an old warehouse in its yard into an oasis of bright white sculptural forms intended to excite children about the idea of form, with lush planting that brought birdsong back to the arid neighbourhood. The goal was to give the kids something that elevated the spirit. Here again, Bob Bates.
And I know when we worked with Michael and Ron and Leo in the very first phase of the school, there was this tremendous sense of that we were doing something extraordinary, that we wanted to spare no expense for these kids. This was for them. We were building this for them, for their future, for their lives, and for their transformation. It was very powerful, and it still is, and we still feel that.
Last week I visited Inner City Arts and met up with a class of fifth graders who were rehearsing lines for Macbeth.
So let the witch one say her first line, and then you can come on stage, okay? So you're still off stage. All right, in 3, 2, 1, action.
By the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes.
Among performers were Orlane and Alex, two fifth graders who come to Inner City Arts from Charles H. Kim School in Koreatown. I asked them for their critical reaction to the building that they come to.
The creators, like, they used a lot of creativity to build it, like in separate buildings and the sideways roofs and all that.
Well, that's why they call it Inner City Arts.
Is Inner City Arts different from where you live or the neighborhood that you live in?
Yes, it's very different because everything here, like over there, like around where we live, there's a lot of people, but here it's like there's not a lot of people here. It's very clear.
Well, where I live, I don't think they use much creativity to make the buildings, and here they used a lot of creativity and put all the work and effort into making this huge place.
20 years later, Michael Moltzen is still involved with Inner City Arts, which has now gone through several expansions and occupies a whole city block. The school, says reporter Morris Newman, is a testament to vision and persistence.
But these people were
they were stubborn. They stuck to it. People were able to envision something that was very, very positive. I mean, we're surrounded by essentially parking lots in an aging industrial district. It's not the first place you or I may have thought about driving through in 1990. Like, I'm going to put a children's art center right here.
David Miranda is an alumnus of Inner City Arts who grew up in the troubled Pico Aliso housing project. For him, the school was a getaway and remains essential, he believes, especially for children in the inner city who face the kinds of deprivations that 20 years ago fueled the civil unrest.
It is an oasis. It's beautiful. The kids today in LA Unified are very fortunate to have Inner City Arts. And considering what's going on in the school district now, whether talking about cutting all arts at the elementary level is just disheartening. But again, it's because Inner City Arts is here, these kids will have the opportunity to explore themselves, explore the arts, and just take that art approach to life. You know, that there is no mistakes, creativity, acceptance of one another.
Michael Moltzen was not the only architect galvanized by the riots into looking for a way to get involved with the city. One of the others was Michael Pride. She founded the Design Professionals Coalition, bringing together multiple different groups who wanted to help out. And she embarked on community-based design, working with the residents of St. Elmo Village in mid-city Los Angeles on improving their buildings.
St. Elmo Village was founded as an artist community by Roselle Sykes in the wake of the Watts riots. So it had all kinds of poetry around that moment. I was devastated by the riots personally, and because of what it meant for my community and my family. On the other hand, the rallying of the Los Angeles community around recovery was so powerful to me.
Morris Newman reports on land use and planning, and he recalls the sense of possibility that was in the air at that time.
It was a utopian moment for architects, but I think it was a utopian moment for the entire city, the sense that we could actually talk to each other, we had some common stuff.
How long do you think that moment lasted?
Oh, maybe 3 months. After a certain point, everyone, normalcy begins to set in, and everyone goes back to their normal lives and their marriages and their jobs and their debts and their daily anxieties, and the focus gets lost.
And even though the initial euphoria did indeed wear off, many in the design community were profoundly shaped by the soul-searching set off by the Rodney King riots. Michael Pride notes that many design schools in LA opened community-based outreach programs, and architects got involved with the civic building that got underway in the later 1990s, new libraries, schools, even police precincts. And following the building of Inner City Arts, Michael Moltzen, who's won acclaim for his high-end homes and arts institutions, he went on to work with Skid Row Housing, designing places for the homeless that he hoped, like Inner City Arts, would elevate the spirit. It was a career path that he says was formed by that moment in 1992.
It catalyzed my belief in this city and my belief in having a role in this city as a young architect, seeing that and having to make a decision whether I was committed to this city or not was a very important moment. I think I realized at that moment that I cared deeply about Los Angeles and that my fascination in the city was even more further cemented, that I wanted to push to see if architecture could make a difference in a city like Los Angeles.
That was KCRW's Francis Anderton, who produced today's Which Way LA, another in this week of special programs 20 years after the Rodney King riots. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Thanks also to Saul Gonzalez and Ray Guarna. Our managing producer is Sonia Geis. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the Rodney King riots and popular culture, gangsta rap, hip-hop, the movies, and Anna Deavere Smith. All this week's programs, plus unedited interviews, videos, and listener comments can be found on the Which Way LA blog at kcrw.com/LA riots. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.